Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusing, and it's time for this week's Friday Morning GM with my co-host, Vas Larikos. Vas, how you doing?
Life is good, Ken. Life is good. Excited for the draft. 1 week from today.
1 week from today, and gonna really enjoy those 3 days. Hope a lot of folks will join us on the shows, and we always have a lot of fun watching it together and doing our interactive thing. Vas will be part of that. Several different avenues for news this week, though. There's an event going on tonight. I am not going. It's made for season ticket holders to talk about a lot of things, but new uniforms seems to be the highlight of the night.
Yeah, we don't quite know. Is this a full revamp? Is it a different alternate? Is it some details or what it really is? Some folks are very excited about that. So happy for them. Hopefully it's a product that everybody likes and it's not too new age for my taste, at least.
Right. New age. I could actually live with new age, but what I can't live with is an unreadable jersey. It's actually very important to be able to read the numbers on the jersey. And I can do that with the current Ravens uniforms. And that's been one of the pleasures of analyzing this team for all these years, is that they're not the Tampa Bay Dolphins. Sorry, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers or the Miami Dolphins, who both have completely unreadable jerseys. I mean, just for various reasons, for different reasons, but they're just terrible. Hopefully they don't stray too far from that. Otherwise, hey, if other people like the look, I'll probably like the look in terms of a new white helmet or this or that. I'm not gonna care too much.
Yeah, that stuff's all good. Just don't want to go crazy with the feathers all over the place or something that looks a little bit juvenile is really where I'm coming from. But I don't think they're gonna do that. What an offseason to change, though. You know, new coaching staff, new uniforms, maybe a little bit new philosophy from the ownership as well. So it's been a whirlwind.
And the same old liar's luncheon. So we had that today out there at the castle. And if you didn't know why it's called that, they actually have lunch they serve to the media out there, and they do it in the middle of the day. And it's a big event. And it was Minter and DaCosta answering questions. Most of it obviously is directed at DaCosta, but there were a few questions directed at Minter as well. Vas and I are just going to kind of alternate through some points we saw from the thing. It was actually yesterday, not today. I'm sorry. In terms of when it was on Wednesday. We're recording this on Thursday. You're hearing this on Friday, so it'd probably be difficult for us to be caught on this directly. But one of the things that DaCosta mentioned is, and he's always seemed to be a consensus builder to me, is that the coaches have been highlighting some guys that they like, who scouts may have not looked at, and they've had additional eyes on the process this year.
For sure. The more time is removed from John Harbaugh's era, we sort of, I think, realized that he had a pretty big impact on the draft, and that should certainly continue with Jesse Minter. Several of the coaches are coming from college, which might be an advantage to the team because they have a little bit more familiarity and some new perspectives, I'm sure. You know, we have, 23 or four new coaches that are new ideas, new thoughts.
And you know, a lot of the coaching backgrounds, if you notice, almost any coach in the NFL who just came from college has been at a bunch of places for 2 years at a time. Ledford, a bunch of places for 2 and 3 years at a time. Mickens actually is 5 years at Notre Dame, but he had multiple other stops before that. A lot of times, particularly the guys who've been in college just the last couple of years, they spent time with some of these players. So in particular, the Notre Dame defensive backs and others, they certainly have connections to, and they have people they can talk to, and they like to watch their film, or that maybe their alma mater and they really like the guys. DaCosta was on somebody's back. The guy was Brandon Burning, is notorious homer for Wisconsin players, supposedly.
Right.
I thought that was really funny.
I caught that. So just on top line, DaCosta said he has 197 draftable players on the board, which is approximately 20 players less than last year. But usually that list doesn't get all the way down to the bottom. If it does, they maybe trade for a future pick. So he thought it was a solid draft overall. He thinks that they're positioned well at number 14. There's a drop off in the first round after that. And one more note, he said it was a deep board at offensive line.
Yeah. Other positions of need too, is one thing he mentioned. One of the interesting points I thought he made, and this sounds like it's a real number. He said historically they try to draft younger players, but the draft board has gone from 4% 24 plus to 18% 24 plus. He said that was a 14% increase. That's a 350% increase, but that's okay. 14 percentage points. I know what he's trying to do here, but that's an enormous relative amount of older players on the board. Now, I don't think that means much for a couple of reasons. First of all, I still don't believe the Ravens will draft old in round one. So Akeem Mesidor, if you're hoping he's taken at number 14, I really doubt it. But we'll see. You know, it is possible. Most certainly, almost certainly, the additional 23, 24, 25-year-olds that are in this group are towards the bottom of the, you know, 197 prospects they have on their draftable board. And that's fine. If you want to draft a 24-year-old in round four, round five, anytime on day three, I'm absolutely fine with it. It just needs to be properly weighted into the overall evaluation of the player, age problem. But very interesting to hear DaCosta say specifically that, you know, with changes in NIL and whatnot, they're significantly up in terms of the number of draftable players they have listed. That are older. He said 24 plus. He also didn't say when he's counting of it. Maybe as of the beginning of the 27th,
week one,
starting 26th season. Yeah, probably. Or it could be as of the draft night.
Yeah. Well, regardless, just to dovetail on with that, you know, he said the NIL is really the driver behind this increased age. Mm-hmm. COVID had something to do with it, but we're well past COVID now. He said it's a little bit problematic to have older players for three reasons. They have less upside, which we've touched on. They have more injuries because they've taken more contact. Mm-hmm. They've played more. And some players that are the younger players are three contract in the NFL players, and these older players are more likely two contract players. So I thought that was, we've talked about that in previous Friday Morning GM. You talked about that with Garnett, and it was interesting mm-hmm. to hear DaCosta spell it out that way.
Yeah, he's being very generous. I mean, three contract players, first of all, in the NFL, exceedingly rare. And yep. when you do get them, it's often base four, one, and one are the three terms of the contract in terms of years mm-hmm. involved. So a three contract player, I mean, I do care in terms of a first round pick that you give yourself a chance for a three contract player, that you give you a chance for a 10-year player kind of thing. But I most care, and the point of inflection, the point of leverage is getting a second multi-year deal done with a quality player, and they're going to be many fewer of those with a player who starts at 25 years old.
Yep, agree. Okay.
All right, let me move on here. He did say, and this is something he said for multiple years, is that the consensus boards he thinks makes the first couple of rounds easier to predict. That he thinks it's easier to see who might be gone in those first two rounds.
Yeah, less slippage is the way he termed it. More consensus, there's fewer sleepers. You know, there's more analytics, there's more information. 10, 20 years ago, the Ravens had an edge on information on players, and they don't necessarily have that quite as much anymore. He said the way to retain that edge is to just have more background intel and information than the other teams.
Yeah, well done. One thing we had hoped to hear, and there was a question asked about Nnamdi Madubuike's future, he says, it doesn't really impact their draft at defensive tackle. They want a good young player because they want a good young player. That's really good to hear. I actually think this is one of these cases where it probably is a little bit of a lie here. They need a three tech. They badly need a three tech. The other position, they've got nose tackle covered multiple times over. It's true that Travis Jones could be moved to the three for the right nose. But I think that they need a three. And the other thing about the Ravens system is, okay, I'm going to call this the Ravens system because we don't know in a lot of ways what the Minter system is going to be like. But Minter played a very similar defensive scheme with the LA Chargers than he's inheriting with the Ravens, specifically with Kyle Hamilton in that slot corner big nickel role. And what that does, this is a very key point, is that really reduces the impact of a possible five tech on the team. Why? Because you don't play as much base defense. You play the base nickel as your way to stop the run a lot of the times in as a substitute for three down linemen. And so the five tech, much smaller role. It's truly a dying position if the Hamilton, James, Emanwori slot corner takes over the game, that most teams are going to have fewer defensive linemen that they can really, I mean, they may activate only four for game and it may be okay rather than having me scream about it.
Yeah, well, as long as they have a backer that can reduce inside and outside backer, I think it can make some sense. Yeah, it's definitely, I agree all around there. So let me move on to my next point. This was just a quick story that I found kind of funny. They said during the Billick years, DaCosta, there was a cash prize for scouts that signed UDFAs that made the team. And I just thought that was kind of interesting. Yeah, I'd never heard that before. I don't know if you were aware of that or not.
No, I wasn't. I mean, the total pool for money for the UDFAs is very small. You know, it's like $150,000 or something. It's gone up a little bit over the years, but it used to be even, you know, smaller than that during the Ozzie era. And they, the Ravens have, as soon as a draft is complete, as soon as the last pick is made, Mr. Irrelevant in round seven, the Ravens are on the phone with agents all over the league trying to get UDFA signed. And it's not just like DaCosta calling agent A, agent B, agent C. They have like 20 guys at the Ravens calling 20 different people. They have probably a set of relationships between scouts and individual players. You know, it may be scouts and families. It may be they, like a few of the cases it's DaCosta, but it's basically a case where they want to be able to lock these guys down as UDFAs as quickly as possible. Ravens are remarkable at that, and they still have a nerve center where those dollars have to be allocated out among the players, but they do know who their priority guys are and who they're willing to spend a few more dollars on. They know who their other guys are, who they want to get at a camp, but they're not willing to spend extra money on. So they do a marvelous job with it, and I think it's they had 3 UDFAs make the team last year, and I think it really shows in terms of value.
There's no question. Absolutely, UDFAs is one of the hallmarks of this organization all the way to the very inception, and it's something that really separates them from other teams, and I think is really helps them have a high floor year in, year out.
I think we got nothing useful on the number of picks. You know, someone, one of the reporters, I don't remember who it was, asked, it was 11 picks, the number you want to end up with, basically. And he said, well, we could end up with 6. We could end up with 14. I'm happy with 11 right now. The Ravens have the fewest players in the whole league under contract. Mm-hmm. I've said that multiple times this offseason. I don't believe they can go down appreciably in terms of the number of picks. Can they move up once? Sure. And, you know, in a later round, sure. In round one, almost certainly not. I know that's come up as a question a little bit later. We'll talk about reasons why that are more practical in terms of the you know, the cost that it would do to make that. But I think they're going to make all 11 picks.
Yeah, 6 picks. There's no chance they're making 6 picks this draft. That's ridiculous. That's the biggest lie that he said all day. Yeah. All right, moving on to another interesting note I had here. On the topic of smaller school guys, which is something we've discussed here on this show a couple times, he said most of the smaller school guys transfer to bigger schools. So that's why there's just not as many smaller school guys, which I think we kind of surmised, but to hear him say it himself was interesting.
Yeah, there still are some, and there are players who, even after they transferred to bigger schools, they had seasons that maybe weren't exactly, didn't tell you everything they need to do. Cole Wisniewski. Go out and look. It's spelled like Wisniewski, but it's pronounced Wisniewski. Look at his season. He had, and he spent 4 years at North Dakota State. His final year at North Dakota State, he had 8 interceptions. And he's a 6'4", 220, kind of hulking safety. I'd love for the Ravens to get him. The ball skills are very apparent there. And he's, you know, he's not a guy who has to step into a role right away, but he's a guy who could step into multiple roles on a defense like this. I'd be very excited about that. But anyway, I think there still are small school guys out there, and I'm a little Ted Hurst this year as a, you know, a wide receiver comes to mind. There are others as well, but,
Bryce Lance.
Yeah.
So yeah. Receivers, third round receivers, hit that box.
Yeah. So anyway, the point being that DaCosta was in charge of small school scouting as one of his early jobs coming up. And he was instrumental in Lardarius Webb and Brandon Williams and others being guys the Ravens drafted out of FCS, what are now FCS programs. And it's sad to me that the Ravens aren't still digging in the same way down there. And it may be that nobody really sees the value in it. I'm wondering if it's not a structural problem that if you're a scout working for the Baltimore Ravens, the last thing you want is to be assigned small school scouting, because basically almost none of your guys are going to get picked. It's kind of like being given Eastern Europe as your sales area for Coca-Cola or for something. You know, you, right. You don't want that, sure. Because it's just not that big a market. Anyway, could be that.
And it could be a smokescreen too. And then maybe they're all over small school guys this year. Yeah. This was interesting to me. DaCosta said that the percentage chance of hitting when your pick plummets in the 5th through 7th rounds. And that to me is a little bit of a change of tune from his previous mythology. So statistically, I agree. The Ravens historically have done better, but not as much lately. And I think Jonas put out a piece with all his day three picks over the last couple of years with showing not too many hits. And maybe DaCosta's playing a little defense there, or maybe it's another smokescreen. But it was a comment that raised my eyebrow.
I think he could be smokescreening, just trying to acquire some late picks. To me, it's they're not lottery tickets. Don't even buy into that BS, because DaCosta doesn't believe it any more than you should. He knows the Ravens have a better chance with all the intel they have to hit on a round 5-7 pick than other teams do. Is it less than round 4, round 3, round 2? Of course it's less. No duh. You know, but, you know, it's still the Ravens, the pick of the Ravens' hand has more value, and DaCosta may well be trying to do that. Now, they've done some things in recent years that have been very unimpressive in late rounds. The draft of Ben Mason and that horrible draft, you know, that was genuinely unimpressive what they did with that. But the notion that they're lottery tickets, or it's a low percentage chance. I forget if it was Minter or DaCosta who made the comment, but he's challenging his scouts to hit on the round 5 picks. They have four of them in this draft. And that was, you know, that to me is exciting. I hope they make those picks, and I hope they hit on 2 or 3 of them.
Yeah. And in that same vein, DaCosta said he's challenging himself to consider new approaches, which I really like to hear, because what worked in 2000 and what worked in 2012 doesn't necessarily work the same way in 2026. You have to evolve with the league. As the league evolves, there's a lot of different tentacles to that point. But to hear DaCosta say that was encouraging to me. There was a period in the late Flacco era where they kind of wanted to seemingly stick to their Ravens way. This is the only way to do it. And now that they're considering new things, I like to hear that.
Well, it's good. And he's not far removed from one of the great Ravens drafts of all time in 22 and another one in 18. Mm-hmm. It's not like they haven't had success pretty much all the way along the line. But he did mention he's asked, I think, a general question about analytics and how that fit in. And his first thing was, I'm not going to tell you anything about analytics, which is that's completely truthful because he didn't.
Proprietary.
But he did talk about Derek Yam as well as several other analytics team members. Now, Derek Yam is the director of data and decision making. The fact that the Ravens have such a position is a very good thing. And that's not the director of football strategy, who used to be Daniel Stern. And is now, I think, Charlie Gellman is the new guy, the 26-year-old guy they got from the Colts. Mm-hmm. So, they have lots of analytics people doing different work. This is Yam's thing, I believe, is a scouting component to this. And he was answering the question in response to how do they kind of fit the puzzle pieces together. And the question wasn't worded this way, in terms of you have a whole bunch of selections you're making over the course of the draft. How do you kind of ensure that your positions of need are hit?
Right. And what positions are going to have, where's the sweet spot for each position? What round? So, yeah. No, that was great to hear. One of the guys he mentioned was David McDonald, who I went to high school with 25 years ago, and he worked his way up. At one point, he was a male cheerleader for the team, and now he's in the analytics department. So, good for him.
Very good.
But, all right. There was a attempt to bait, I don't know if bait's the right word, but to get Minter and or DaCosta to acknowledge that they're looking for a trench focused draft. Minter said, always want to be strong in the line of scrimmage. And I like the way he said that. DaCosta said he wants to be strong everywhere. It kind of pushing back against this has to be a trench or a line of scrimmage focused draft. He wants an influx of young talent at all positions. I think he said you can have the best offensive line in the league and the best defensive line in the league, but if you don't have explosive receivers and coverage players, you're not going to win anything. So anyway, that's always been my theory. I want the most balanced team. I've always been a strength in the weakness, not strength in the strength. And I know some teams are like, we have a good group. We have Patrick Mahomes. Let's surround him with 5 second round picks, or we have a tremendous pass rush. Let's continue adding to that. My theory has always been for more balance, so you're more versatile and you're ready for any game script. So I like to hear that part.
Absolutely, more balance, better. I like it for multiple reasons. You're good to play the game multiple ways. I think it's also important is you got to balance your future rebuilding efforts. You don't want to have to rebuild a position group all at the same time in the future. And the place where the Ravens kind of failed in that way is the tight end position this year. Is they're having to rebuild, and it's going to be a painful process. Hopefully they get the guys that they want in this draft, and it works out. But anyway, I think that's pretty much what I wanted to hit on. Anything else you had that was?
DeCosta said they cut positions from the sequence after they pick them early, which we kind of knew, but I think that's the first time I've ever heard him say that in words. Other than that, Minter had a comment that players that transfer may be more adept at getting ready for the pro level, but otherwise it was pretty milquetoast.
He also said one more thing was they probably would not trade up and give up a ton to do that kind of thing. So yeah. We've got various questions about that. We'll get a chance to address that again. So Voss, I wanted to go through a process here where we try and do a 3-round mock for the Ravens. And you're going to see this is going to break down very quickly in terms of wanting to draft a balanced set of positions and whatnot at those top three. And, you know, what talent may be available. But what we're trying to use is Dane Brugler's list, as it's been reported to us, and a great question by Jake Vogel. So Jake Vogel provided us some options at each of these rounds, which will basically be selected. Are you selecting from that, or are you going for a broader set, Voss?
No, I guess I may be going from a broader set. I did peruse Brugler's mock individually, so I might have a couple more players that, but probably most overlap.
Okay. All right. Well, fair enough. And let me get to the question here. And you maybe have it in front of you. If you do, that's great.
I have Jake's look. I don't have the question, but I have a screenshot of his first round. So first round, Carnell Tate went at 7. Spencer Fanneau went at 10. And Jake has the options on the board of Vega, McCoy, Lemon, and Sadiq.
Okay. So you go ahead and pick one of those. I've got my guy.
So first of all, let me just preface by saying in this situation, I would really strongly consider a trade back and take one of the edge rushers that are projected to go at the end of the first round, whether that's Young, whether that's Falk, whether that's Parker, and you get an additional third that you can use to fill another. But as far as how I would sequence these players, I would have Ioane would be my top choice, with McCoy as a close runner-up.
I go Vega, Sadiq, McCoy, and Lemon in that order. So Sadiq is the guy from a franchise building perspective I just love for the Ravens. I do, I want an offensive lineman very badly, like most other people. Fano would be my number one choice, but he's already off the board here. Even a higher choice than Fano would be Mauinoa if it came to that. So few different choices.
I really hope that this is, I don't consider a cornerback an immediate need for 2026, hypothetically, but if McCoy was there and he was the top guy, I would make that exception because you're going to need a starting corner most likely next season. So I would flip Sadiq and McCoy, but otherwise we're in lockstep.
Okay, so you're not buying into the year 5 valuation, or you are buying into it, but you just don't think he meets the other standards for Sadiq in terms of what he would add to the passing game.
I think you have more surplus value with Vega and McCoy during their rookie contract before. And there's certain things that concern me about him that, the production potentially. So I think he'd be a little bit riskier. I wouldn't be upset or dislike the pick, but he's not the top, he'd be third in the sequence.
Okay. Fair enough. And Delaine would still go ahead of McCoy, and Delaine was not available, correct?
Yeah. Delaine was gone. Yep. No, Noah was gone. Bain was gone. Let me go to the second round.
Sure, let's go to the second round.
So just sneak behind the curtain, we were discussing how we were going to structure this last night, and I just kind of picked three guys that I wanted at each pick after kind of cross-referencing to see if there was a reasonable likelihood they would be available. And the three guys I wrote down before we decided to go with this format were Zion Young, Chris Bell, and Caleb Banks. They went 42, 43, and 44 in Brugler's mock. So my board got wiped out there.
Well, let me respond to one of those, because Chris Bell, I mean, I wouldn't touch him with a 10-foot pole, even at 45. He's coming off a big injury history, might not play this year, potentially a very good player, but he's going to lose a year of development in all likelihood.
I heard that he was most likely expected to play this year, but if he wasn't able to play the full year, that would change my take.
Okay.
So Jacob Vogel here had listed the options: R. Mason Thomas, Gabe Yakas, Christian Miller, D'Angelo Palms, Emmanuel Pregnon, and Keelan Rutledge.
All right. I mean, I've got thoughts, but you want to go first?
Go ahead. And then you go, okay. And I'll follow you.
Okay. So let's talk about some guys I would eliminate right off the bat. D'Angelo Pons, fantastic slot corner. Loved the player. Ate the fit for the Ravens. I had him at 15th on my cornerback board. I couldn't go any higher than that on him. R. Mason Thomas, number 10 on my edge board. I like Akis better of Illinois, who's number 8 on my edge board. And then you got a couple interior defensive linemen you got only one, right? Christian Miller. Who is one of the guys. He definitely is one of the guys they'd have to consider. Keon Rutledge, who's a guard, and Emmanuel Pregnon as a guard. Of that group, I probably would go Pregnon, Akis, and I'm not sure after that. It's very close among the other three, Thomas, Miller, and Rutledge.
So I agree. I would eliminate Thomas. He's undersized, and I want a power player on edge. And I totally agree with your thoughts on Pons. I'm not interested in a slot receiver, really, at any round. You already have three in the
slot corner. Yeah.
Slot corner. I'm sorry. Pardon me. So I would go. I think I'm with you. Pregnon. If you have Ioane in the first, you don't go Pregnon, but I would go Pregnon, Yakas, Rutledge. I'm not that excited about Miller. One player I would toss in the mix who was available is Malachi Fields.
Malachi Fields, the Notre Dame wide receiver. Yeah, so we had a discussion about him on the wide receiver, and a lot of people know that Maureen is a Notre Dame alumnus, and I watch the games with her occasionally. But one thing is very true is I don't really like Malachi Fields and the number of contested target, the amount of contested target risk. So I had him at 20th on my board, and wow. Jason had him at 10th among the wide receivers. So that was one of our big discrepancies. The other one was, I'm forgetting who it was, but I had a guy high, obviously, who he had lower was the other way.
Got it.
All right.
All right. Third round.
Surratt. Surratt was the guy. Indiana's wide receiver.
You had him higher?
I had Surratt higher, yes.
Okay. Yeah. Gotcha. That's the prototype. To me, it's an X. That's the target, the position to be targeting. So, okay. Third round. I'm not going to list who won earlier. I will say Stribling, who's another receiver, went in the second, as well as Fields in Brugler's mock. So Jake has at number 80, choices are Trey Zune, Jalen Farmer, Sam Hecht, Jayshon Barham, Jake Slaughter, Romello Height, Antonio Williams, and Dalen Everett.
Okay, you want to go first this time?
No, I can. I would be all over Slaughter at this pick. I think he's the highest floor center. Maybe not the highest ceiling, but he's the most plug and play as far as immediate, no projection, no position change, doesn't have any glaring weaknesses. And then Zune would probably be the second in my sequence here. And Brian Parker would probably be in the mix as well. I do think that at number 80, I'm hoping they get a center, because I'm concerned that if they wait till 115, the board might be picked pretty dry.
All right. Well, so Brian Parker is available here in the fourth round. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp.com. For some, summer is their favorite season. Travel picks up, kids are out of school, and adventure is the focus. For others, juggling it all can be tough, can make you feel overwhelmed, and can make you count down the minutes until the kids are back in school. I know I look forward to summer as a time to take a break, but as a self-employed person, time spent away from my work is time I stress over wasting. That's where BetterHelp comes in. BetterHelp is a quality therapist who work according to a strict code of conduct and are fully licensed in the U.S. BetterHelp does the initial therapist matching for you so you can focus on your therapy goals. A short questionnaire helps identify your needs and preferences, and their 12-plus years of experience and industry-leading match fulfillment rate means they typically get it right on the first time. If you aren't happy with your match, switch to a different therapist at any time. With over 30,000 therapists, BetterHelp is the world's largest online therapy platform, having served over 6 million people globally, and it works. With an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session based on 1.7 million client reviews. You don't have to say yes to everything this summer. Find support in therapy. Sign up and get 10% off at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com. So he's definitely the center I'm taking. I have him rated higher than both Hecht and Slaughter. In fact, that Parker, Hecht, Slaughter are 8, 9, 10. I have a fourth round grade on all three of them. I had various problems with a lot of the centers in this draft. It's, I know a lot of people think it's a great draft for an interior offensive line, and there are some guys at the top who are really good. And then the centers that are in the group all have a variety of warts other than possibly Spencer Fano, who hasn't really played very much at the position. Parker is probably the best. He's a tackle, you know, would be moving to center. Connor Liu would be another guy who, you know, played guard at Auburn, but I guess it's possible he could end up at center. Sam Hecht and Jake Slaughter, they've got their own problems. And it gets worse after that with Logan Jones, with Jalen Farmer, who have some bigger problems that are interior offensive linemen as well. But if Jayshon Barham is a defensive lineman or edge.
He's an edge from Michigan. More of the Sam type, so he's got some off ball ability too.
Yeah, well, right there, that's interesting. I had him at number 16 and a fourth round grade on him, and I believe he might be a Maryland guy originally. Barham, I'm not 100%.
I think both the Michigan guys are from Maryland. Yeah, Barham.
Romello Height I had higher on my board, but I don't want to touch him anywhere near the third round, even though I think he'll go then. He's an older guy, and I'd stay clear. So I would be okay. I wouldn't be really enamored. I think it's too early for Trey Zune. I think he's a mildly over-projected prospect, but I do, you know, he has a great RAS score, and he generally, you know, checks some of the bills. He's just got a tall, lean frame. And there'll be some questions about his ability to not get pushed around by big interior defensive linemen. He'll be changing positions, you know, so there's some reasons to be concerned. I'm not so excited about Dylan Everett as a cornerback or Antonio Williams that I want them. So I guess of the names that he has here, I probably would take Zune of that group. And if I'm forced to take a center, if I'm forced to take from these names, I take Hecht. But since he's got Parker down in the fourth round, I'm eyeing up him as the center at number 115.
Okay, very good. So I guess let's hit the fourth round, and then we'll get to some other questions if you like, Ken.
Sure.
So Jake, in this scenario, at pick 115, Skylar Bell, Brian Parker, Devin Moore, Julian Neal, and Will Lee the third.
So interesting group of players. Parker is one of my draft crushes this year. So I'll go with him, and then I'll let you pick from this group. Skylar Bell, a wide receiver, right? And Skylar Bell are both there. And if I recall, Skylar Bell is a smaller guy. Brian Parker is a center at Duke, who's been an academic, all academic in the ACC. So he's a brainy guy. I think he moves in and he leads the line right away. I think it's fairly seamless in terms of that. There are questions about whether or not he can handle the position, but he's played tackle well in the ACC, and he's a short arm guy, so that's necessitating the move. The other thing is, and this I really like, is a lot of the tackles, they kind of want to be drafted as either versatile offensive linemen or get a chance to play their college position. He's embracing the move to center already. In fact, I believe whatever his East West Shrine game or the Senior Bowl, whichever one he went to, he was taking reps at center there. And that I really like when the player commits early to that.
Don't quote me on this, but if I recall reading in The Beast, he played center in high school, which is pretty unusual. It might have been a different player, but he played center in high school, tackle in college, and now he's projected back to center. And before I move on, I forgot to mention, when I first made my list at the third round pick, the player that I really was targeting is somebody you mentioned earlier, Ted Hurst, the wide receiver. Mm-hmm. So fourth round, I'm not really enamored with any of these guys that Jake's recommending. And I really think the guy that he has still available in the fifth round would be a great pick in the fourth round. Grayson Halton. He's a situational three tech, low snap counts, but I would be all about him in the fourth. Justin Jolly was still available, the tight end. And I think Rashawn Benny could be in the mix in the fourth round too.
Those are all good players. And Halton in particular, there's only about three guys in this draft who really meet the athletic three tech type that the Ravens would want to, you know, penetrating pass rushing three tech to pair with Travis Jones. Now they can go another route. They can get Reuben Bain I mean, my God, they'd bump him in inside, I'm pretty sure, on third down and let him try and play over guard. They could go a lot of different ways with the pass rush. But if they want an athletic three tech, then there's a relatively limited number of choices, and Holton is one of them.
Yeah. So that would be the positional value, or the scarcity value would make me more willing to take him earlier, because there's not as many.
Yeah. Well, you're not is going need versus value there at that point. You might lose out slightly, but you're not going to lose out on a lot of JJ value at that pick. Right. And if you're taking him in the fourth or fifth round, where I really can't stand it is when people do it in the first or second round, where there's a lot of points on the line. I mean, it's just a lot of total draft capital on the line. And if you overpay for something by 30% at that point, you really screw your franchise.
Yeah. Yep. Agreed.
All right. Okay. Let me make sure we get back to my notes for the show itself and make sure that we're where we want to be. Go to the mailbag, right? For the rest of the mailbag?
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. David Powell?
You go first, but bring up the first question if you want.
So this is for the first one was Jake, which we already touched on. I guess too late to read the question now. I just had it right in front of my face and didn't see it. So this is from JD at David Powell 902. Assuming you have finished all your analysis on the draft prospects, is there a position this year that really excites you, meaning it's so deep, rounds 1 through 7, they could find really good value?
Tight end, easily. I mean, it's the biggest group of tight ends I've ever seen. It's 21 deep and whatnot, that with names that have done something in college that bring real value. I think there's going to be guys who go a lot later than expected. And it is... one of the troubling things, the Ravens need two tight ends, in my opinion. So I don't think it matters if they get Sadiq and one of the player. Also, don't think it really matters if they're going to blur the lines between 11 and 12 personnel, that they draft two tight ends, carry four, and have a guy. But they're probably going to want a blocking guy. The guy I absolutely love for as a blocking tight end this draft is Indiana's Nowakowski. Out, big play waiting to happen, breaks tons of tackles, gets out in space, and is very hard to bring down. He's kind of like Patrick Ricard in terms of being a very athletic, bigger man to block for you up front. And he weighs 250. He's not, he doesn't weigh 310, or Ricard has probably been playing around 270 the last couple of years. So he doesn't weigh as much, but he gives you a lot more offensive burst when he has the football in his hands. So it'll be very exciting for that. And I think he'd be the guy on day three that I'm really going to jump out of my seat if the Ravens get him.
Very good. I agree with you. It's a deep tight end class. There's guys like Koziel, who's projected to go in the 6th or 7th, that a lot of people like. I personally like Oscar Delp out of Georgia, who's, if you can get him early day three, he's got pretty good tape, pass blocking, a lot of athletic upside. So I would agree that that's the position, rounds 1 through 7. One just thing I'd point out, the day two outside linebacker class, in my view, is better than usual. There's a lot of guys that can transition. So I would also be pretty excited if they can land somebody in that range.
I'm with you on that. I think the edge group is very good. The interior offensive line group that are interior offensive linemen to start is probably a little bit better than normal this year. Yeah, and then there's a whole mess of guys who are going to move inside, and everybody knows it already. And it's not like in past years where people are pretending like these guys with 32.5-inch arms are still going to be staying at tackle. And it's general consensus belief. The players themselves are not trying to do it. They're not trying to fool the world and into being something that they're not. And it's just I think it's a nice draft for the interior offensive line, and probably it might be a little bit light for left tackles this year specifically. And it's good that the Ravens don't specifically need that with Stanley backed up by Vincent right now.
Yeah, it is light for left tackles, but there could be 11 offensive linemen drafted in the first. This month, Dane Brugemark had Bashantis in the first, Pregnon's been in the first, Rutledge has been in the first certain places. So we'll see.
How excited would you be to trade back? Now, you mentioned a trade back earlier to trade back to get an edge rusher, and the possibility being they could trade back and pick up a third round pick. To me, that's not enough. I mean, I'll tell you why in a second, because I don't think 18 is the sweet spot for a lot of these secondary edge rushers. I think it's more like 22, 26 is where the sweet spot is. So that's two trade backs, and you know, to just get to 22, that you pick up 2 third-round picks. Now I'm starting to get more excited about it. You know, then well, the future, then
27, maybe a third round pick this year and one next year too.
Oh, that could. I'm for that. I'm always for, you know, picking up, especially if somebody's going to discount the value of the future pick to, I'm all for that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Zion Yugs. Yeah, I do. Trade up. Start with the 7th to a 6th to a 5th to a 4th, all the way up the ladder. Uh-huh. Zion Young is a guy I really, really like if a trade back option. He's, to me, he's reminiscent of Clowney. He brings a lot of what Clowney would as a free agent pickup.
How are you feeling about Mesidor if he was the guy they traded back to get at 18?
I think I prefer Falk to Mesidor. Mm-hmm. And Dane Brugler had Falk going 11 in this mock.
Wow.
11. So I think I would go Falk as far as the tier two guys. Falk, Young, Mesidor, Parker. Those would be the four.
Falk, Young, Mesidor, Parker. I might even have Parker in front of Mesidor. I'd have to look at that. I'm very concerned about Mesidor accumulating his outstanding year at exactly the right time in terms of his own age and polish relative to the guys around him. So, and also just the circumstances at Miami. I mean, you know, he's got Reuben Bain on the other side. It's a fantastic defense top to bottom, but particularly on the front.
When the season ended, even after the national championship game, they were saying Mesidor's a second or third round pick. And now all of a sudden he's, you know, projected to be first rounder. And I never saw that jump to be, you know, really worthwhile or rational.
I did want to say one other thing about Falk. Falk might get into the scarcity game. James Ogden and I did the interior, did the edge group and that show. And what he had Falk among his interior defensive linemen, where he would rate much higher. He could be the number one interior defensive lineman, even over Woods, who is, you know, he's a solid player, but mainly I think Woods is towards the top of or in the middle of round one because he's so much better than the rest of the class at the position, which is kind of a down year.
That's definitely also under tackle.
All right, let's go to the next question here. Will Saunders says, Ken, as the roster stands, it doesn't appear to be a number one red zone option. Andrews lost a step. Bateman and Flowers haven't shown that ability. Do you believe the Ravens must draft a big weapon within the first two rounds of the draft? Thanks. Okay, Will, I think there is a special situation that the Ravens have, which means they probably don't need to draft such a position. First of all, Andrews has been, you know, reasonably successful in terms of scoring touchdowns as recently as 24. I don't remember what his touchdown total was in 25, but he had some. Bateman had a fair number. But the most important thing is that Lamar Jackson is a quarterback who does not really throw a fade pass. So you don't have a need for a big Megatron or other huge player on the edge when your quarterback is trying to move laterally along the line of scrimmage and find a direct laser that he can throw to somebody can see. And Zay Flowers has been effective in that. Bateman's been effective in that. I don't think that that's a problem at all for the Ravens. And, you know, Lamar went all that time to start his career without throwing an interception in the red zone. Mm-hmm. So I don't know stats recently. I'm sure he's thrown some, but I don't see that as being a need. I don't think a size/fade option is really an important need to the Ravens.
No, I agree. I don't think it's a fade option is the need necessarily. Now, Flowers has not produced in the red zone like some other wide receiver ones. I will say that. But you have Tez Walker who he actually caught one of the fade balls Lamar did throw in the end zone. Was his first catch of his career, right? Out of the slot, I think. And he caught a fade in the back of the end zone.
Are we talking about – it was a 20-yard throw that was lined up to get him free behind the defense. Yeah. It wasn't like a 4 to 6 yard throw or anything. It's 20-yard touchdown at the Meadowlands.
So I sort of agree with Will that they need – I think they need more receivers to replace Hopkins and Likely, who were two of their bigger red zone targets last year, but not necessarily for the red zone, just to have the depth on the roster – to be able to afford an injury and not have that derail your season like it did a few years back when Hollywood go down and they were bare, or was it Bateman? And they were throwing day three guys and they were starting a receiver. So you need more depth there. I think they will address double dip a tight end and hopefully a receiver somewhere in the top 100.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. We go to Angelov85. Hi, Ken and Voss. Thank you for the continued excellent content. Appreciate you, Angelov. We do appreciate your regular questions too. If EDC was willing to trade away two first round picks for Crosby, how upset would you be if he traded number 14 for a premium veteran plus a day two pick, which is where the real value of this draft is? If that happens on draft night, you'll actually be able to see how upset I am for when it happens. But it will be is the starting position is. I would not be excited about it. You know, if the kind of discussion you're talking about would be the Cowboys to the Packers guy, number 11.
What position?
Yeah, the edge rusher who went last year for two first.
Micah Parsons.
Yeah. Jeez, I'm having trouble with names here. That's terrible. But anyway,
trying to remember 100 draft prospects at once. That's hard.
But this guy's been in the league for a few years. So anyway, Micah Parsons. If they made a trade of that caliber, I still probably wouldn't be really excited about it. And I'm not gonna the day two, the value of the day two pick in this draft would still be 1/7, 1/8 of what you're giving away with two first round picks.
I think she's only saying one first round, just number 14.
No, it's if EDC was willing to trade away two first round picks for Crosby. Oh, okay. No. You're very good. Very good. Okay, yeah. Angelov. I'll still be upset, but I'll be less upset. And it depends on the player, I guess.
Yeah, to me, this is a lot more palatable is the word I'm looking for, because it's not necessarily that double whammy where you're giving up two picks for one player, mm-hmm. or you're giving up a pick and a contract for one player. You're basically doing a one for two. So you're gaining two, giving one. And the difference between the player at number 14 and the player you're going to get in the second round, particularly this year, might not be that much of a difference. You are sacrificing the fifth-year option value. But if it was an early day two pick, and we're talking about like some of those, like a Zion Young or something like that, or one of the Chase Besantis as a guard, and you're also adding premium veteran to be named, I could see it. I wouldn't hate it. It would obviously depend on who the players are.
Yeah. So I'll agree with you that it depends. I will say this. There is no reversing a trade like that. If you make the trade on draft night, it's an as-is trade. You're accepting the player without a physical. So I also wouldn't be excited about that. I'd be concerned about how the Ravens, you know, are taking some getting hoodwinked risk if they acquire a player on draft night.
Yeah, to me, it wouldn't be a 30-year-old guy. I was kind of thinking somebody nearing the end of the rookie contract who doesn't have mm-hmm. as much wear and tear that, you know, doesn't whatever for whatever reason, like Brian Thomas, the receiver for Jacksonville, who's apparently been rumored to be on the market. Anyway, that's a scenario that we'll see what happens.
All right. G-E-E says, any chance the Ravens jump in round one? All right. We hit on this briefly earlier because DaCosta has basically said he didn't really think that they'd trade a lot to move up. And he may have been thinking about trading two firsts to get up number five or something like that. But I think I'd pretty much rule it out even for a four slot move up, which is the most the Ravens could do, in my opinion. The four slot move up will cost them their third round pick. Mm-hmm. If you just, you know, want that, maybe you like Reuben Bain and you want to get him at number 10 and maybe you can now. If it's Malanoa drops at number 10, am I that much more excited about it? Maybe. You know, now we're talking about a more reasonable possibility. I don't think I'd do it for the corners. I don't think the difference between Delane and McCoy is enough for me to make a jump for a third round pick, to do it. If you're talking about the two offensive linemen and it's Fano or Vega, I wouldn't do it for that. So I wouldn't do it.
I would do it because I'm hoping that they can walk away from this draft feeling hopefully four of the five needs, as I see it, the five big needs, immediate needs.
What are the five? Identify them directly for us.
Center, receiver, tight end, edge, and defensive tackle.
No cornerback in there.
No, I don't consider that an immediate need. I would take McCoy if he's there, but I think with the re-signing of Awuzie and hypothetically Tampa being coached under Mickens and Minter and Marlon maybe rebounding with the change back to the technique that Rod Woodson was talking about, I think they're okay at corner. I'm not saying they're the strongest position in the world, but they're not desperate like they are at maybe center or tight end as it sits right now. So here's the other thing. Well, not just to mention, I was listening to James Ogden and Gordon McGinnis's podcast this morning, driving my son to the bus stop. And Gordon's final prediction was that the Ravens would trade up for Carnell Tate, the wide receiver. Now, that's a player where I think he's probably the sixth or seventh best player in the draft. I do think that
considering how far did he have him moving up? To 10?
Not very much. Yeah, like 10. I wouldn't go beyond. I wouldn't trade it up at all.
I'm wondering what Gordon said. Did Gordon say they're going to 10 to get Tate? Is that what he wanted?
He didn't. I don't think he put a number on it. He just said final prediction, moving up for Tate. Yep.
All right. So one more here from Be More Fella says, Ken, what are your thoughts on some tackle prospects in terms of left tackle potential in the midterm and guard performance in the interim? By the way, great question. Because there will be a need at tackle, perhaps in 27, but almost certainly in 28. And one of the things that's come up, and I don't think we've hit on this on the show, so it's worth important to say, Ronnie Stanley's contract has apparently been restructured, and they can't really cut him for the 28 season, or sorry, for the 27 season anymore. I don't know if you saw
that.
So take a look. It's got a bunch of void years strapped onto it now. Basically, the salary for this year is cut to the minimum, and that means they're not going to be able to cut him in 27, which is I don't know how I feel about that, other than I now feel like they're kind of handcuffed to Ronnie Stanley for better or for worse, for the next 2 years.
That old maid risk that you like to talk about, that's news to me. I admit that one flew over under my radar, and I don't know how I feel about it either.
But anyway, if he mentions some guys here, if it's, first of all, Mauno, of course, a guy who can certainly play tackle and can absolutely play guard, might be a better guard even. Fano, he's the highest rated of the guys that I think we reasonably could get, and my highest rated interior offensive lineman. Freeling, I'm not even sure I wouldn't take Freeling right now, but I would definitely feel like I really had something to trade. If Freeling drops into the Ravens' lap at number 14, I'd be working the phones pretty hard trying to trade that pick and seeing if it could be done. But then if you're going to do that, you better be willing to draft the guy too, because they better hear that in your voice. The trader on the other end of the line better hear that in your voice. And some people who've worked at desk before, you understand what I mean by that. Miller, sure, outstanding prospect in Lomu of Utah, another one who could certainly be there. Boy, that Utah offensive line was great in terms of having those two tackles at once. But any of those, if they drop into the Ravens' lap for some reason, that's fine. If they overpay because it's a tackle poor draft, then I'm upset about it. So the chance for the Ravens to have something fall into their lap is probably at 14 and not later, because I think the premium for tackles is going to be in place by that point. And then through the rest of the draft, you're going to really see what you normally see with left tackles being over projected where they go.
Left tackle is definitely the one position on the whole roster that you want to future proof if you can, succession plan, because they're so hard to find. With Stanley under contract through 28, plus Carson Vincent, who I think some folks in the 27, plus Carson Vincent, who I think a lot of Ravens pundits are forgetting is on the roster, and they're saying we need a left tackle of the future. We might already have the guy.
I hope so.
One other thought I would have. If you do take offensive linemen where you have essentially more guys you want to get on the field than you have spots for, and you're a little bit short at tight end, some 6-0 line formations might be able to solve two problems at once.
That's possible. And you know, you, especially if you're talking about not having a blocking tight end, you could, right. you could go to have a guy who's your regular guy. You know, a lot of NFL teams are doing that right now. Anderson right. and exactly. Buffalo and some other people are regularly on the field for that. The Ravens had Ricard, so they didn't need to do it, but they, yeah, mm-hmm. you're right. It's a, that would be a possibility. I don't think the Ravens can have a fourth offensive tackle on their roster because you cannot carry four on game day. Realistically, you only have eight offensive. Well, okay, you could put any number of offensive linemen, but you get effectively a bonus for putting an eighth offensive lineman on the game day roster that they do anything they can to avoid by having a defensive lineman, offensive lineman, or a you know a fullback right. who they claim is a guard or whatever they might be doing. You know, they really only want to have seven. They're forced to pick eight, but there's no way it's going to be four tackles. It's you know it'd be three tackles, one swingman, and one, and you know, and the rest IOL are going to be the furthest they could go with that.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Emory Jones might be a guy that could work as a sixth lineman yeah. potentially if they draft over him and he doesn't have a place to play. I think 10 on the 53 isn't unreasonable, but I agree with you as far as game day activations doesn't make any sense. So you know, I think they need to get instant contributions from most of these early round picks, at least going down to the fourth, hopefully the fifth even. And then once you get past there, go ahead and go for some developmental succession planning.
Yeah. And they could, if they potentially have a fourth on the roster on a 10 man offensive line, which they guess they could do if they tighten up somewhere else, like probably tight end or running back, mm-hmm. carry one less could be wide receiver also, then I'd be okay with that. I mean, that's kind of a bet on Ledford to develop somebody in the future, and I'd be okay with that.
Yeah.
All right. Voss, always a pleasure to do this show with you. I think that exhausts the questions. By the way, thanks for the wonderful questions, everybody. Week after week, this is one of the really fun segments to do is go through your mailbag and talk about these. I think they're fantastic stuff. But tell folks where they can find whatever you're doing online, and maybe if you have a new restaurant you're working on right now, tell us about
it. I'm working on two ventures at the moment, but I'm not at liberty to disclose. Sure. Ken, first of all, always a pleasure doing this show with you, my friend. I did put out a Ravens Way episode with Yuri last Thursday that is available on YouTube, and we got some firsthand knowledge of a lot of the prospects from Yuri's time at the Senior Bowl, and he and I pretty discussed relatively extensively the archetypes that the Ravens are looking for, because it's not just you want a receiver or you want a center, you know, you want specific traits. Other than that, I look forward to co-hosting your live draft stream next Friday night.
There we go. So we hope if you're out there and you're a listener and you've always said, you know, I'd really love to be on that draft, I'd like to be a panelist on that, contact me. I'll work you in at a minimum for an hour or two on one of the 3 days. And I'll just let me know. So you can contact me directly by DM on Twitter. They're always open, or by email if you'd like to, at filmstudy21@verizon.net. And I'd love to hear from you. I'll certainly get back. And I'm going to be putting out a general appeal for this to the Reddit community. So if you're in the Reddit community and listening, outstanding thought over there. And I really want to get some people involved from that group who I don't normally know are involved in draft streams across it. Maybe I just don't know them by name. And that's the problem. But I know I've met some new people and really appreciated having them on the show. Anyway, that'll do it for Friday Morning GM today. For Voss Ricos, this is Ken McCusick saying goodbye, and we'll talk to you next week. All right.